Hi, I'm Terry, Instagram's sassy sober mum. Welcome to my podcast, Sober Stories from Everyday People. Bringing you stories from people just like you and I, the aim of this podcast is to share our experiences with drinking and how we got and stayed successfully sober. Just before we jump into the episode this week, I wanted to share a little bit about the Thrive community that I run. It's a place where many like-minded women go to connect and share their experience with getting and staying successfully sober. There are different sections, like the main Thrive community feed, where people post about things that are up and coming or about challenges they're facing, and they get incredible support from other members of the group. It really is a special, special place to be right now. There are also sections to share your milestones, because every win, even the really small ones, are a big thing to celebrate, and we acknowledge that. There are Thrive events, there are the weekly Zoom recordings, so you can go back and see all the weekly Zoom meetings and all the topics that have been covered in those meetings at your own leisure. There's a share sober tips section, and then there are group chats for the first 30 days, the first 100 days, the first year, and over a year. There's a knowledge hub as well, and in the knowledge hub you'll find a place for books and book recommendations. There's a section of how to survive the first 30 days. So if you come in completely brand new to getting sober, you can hit the ground running and find tools and information to get a structure set up for yourself from the outset. There's also my Thrive Sober program. There's a toolkit. There's understanding the brain science and a space to read and learn about all the topics under emotional sobriety, most of which have been written by myself. So come into Thrive. If you're thinking about it or you're lacking community, I would say just jump in and go for it. And maybe we'll see you in there soon. Hello and welcome to Sober Stories from Everyday People. Today I'm going to be talking to Charlotte. She's in Margate and she is 579 days sober at the time of this recording. Thank you for joining me, Charlotte. It's lovely to talk to you today.
And you, Terry. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. Before we jump into your story with alcohol and all the benefits of sobriety, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so I am a single mum. I am in my 30s. I'm currently at university studying to improve my career. The reason that I decided that I was going to give up alcohol was to concentrate on that and obviously to embrace being a single mum.
Yeah. And we were talking just before we click record that you got your medal wall behind you and that you're really into fitness and all the things. And we were, talking about, I was saying when I was a single parent, when I was 39, I think that happened, I launched into fitness and used it as a form of therapy and had my own little medal wall. I'm feeling a bit envious of your medal wall. I feel like I want to make my medal wall again.
Yeah, you should definitely do it.
I've got to go find where they live. They're somewhere in a box, not being appreciated.
Pick them up with the little command hooks.
Yes, I think I just use like little nails actually. I'm bad for that. Just go around my house just putting nails in the wall everywhere and hanging things up. But you look very fit and really, really well. So I'm sure that's a big part of your story. So let's get into that. So what was your life with alcohol like?
So I was your typical party girl, life and soul of the party. I started drinking alcohol from a really young age, actually, teenager. By year 8, year 9, It was part of like the weekend thing to be down the park, typical drinking, socializing with lots of other children, shall we say, even though we were teenagers and didn't feel like we were children. I think looking back, the reason that alcohol and socialising was really important to me is because I was quite lonely in my childhood. I think it sort of escalated. I didn't cope very well in school. And I just lived for socialising and I went to school to socialise. So alcohol just naturally came part of that. So yeah, so we used to go out and get drunk a lot. And then around the age of 16, when I decided to leave school and just embrace work, I started an apprenticeship and I socialised with people that were a lot older than me because my colleagues were older. Mm. So by 16, I was clubbing. I was partying, I was clubbing. My mum was okay with that. Because my friends were older, she was like, oh, you know, they'll look after you. So I just remember going clubbing at like 16 and just literally feeling like I was the bee's knees, like able to buy alcohol and just in this really grown up environment. So just loved it, loved the dopamine that I got from it, and how I felt. And then at about 17, I then met my now ex-husband who, is ex-army. So again, part of a huge drinking culture. As a soldier, like, you are encouraged to drink, to suppress how you're feeling, to decompress to the experiences and stuff that you've been exposed to. So we just had this share of just partying, having fun, alcohol, everything surrounded alcohol, like everything we did. You know, we couldn't even go for a meal without getting absolutely blottoed. So we just both enjoyed that. It just intensified. It was really central to us both, like when we were together we drank, when we was apart we drank, when I socialized with the girls, that's what we did. We went out and got drunk. He did the same with the lads. And it was just our life, you know. I had children quite young. I was only 22 when I had my first baby. I gave up drinking, smoking, both pregnancies. Like, for me, my children were more important. But I really missed it. So as soon as I'd had my first child, I couldn't wait to get back to socialising and drinking because that was the only way I knew how to socialise as well, was alcohol. So I had her, and then as soon as I stopped breastfeeding, which for some crazy reason I told myself that I was only going to breastfeed for 3 months because that was my limit and then I could get back to my drinking. So I did. So I breastfed her for 3 months, didn't drink alcohol, and then straight away the nights out resumed. And because he still worked away and I was solely, you know, single-handedly looking after her by myself, again, the nights out were really important for me to decompress. Yeah. So, like, I'd be straight out with the girls, and that was the only way that I felt like I could cope with my role as a parent.
Mm.
It's the only adult time I got because it was just me and her for a long time. And then had my second child a couple of years later. And again, I did the same, gave up alcohol while I was pregnant. But that time round, I couldn't wait to get back to it because I was like, oh my God, I'm going from one baby to two baby. I'm on my own. You know, he wasn't around very much at all. I couldn't wait to get back to work, couldn't wait to get back to drinking with the girls, like just to feel like me again. So I did the same. So just straight back into alcohol after 3 months of breastfeeding. And then as a family, we decided to move. So we moved from one end of Kent to the other. So we came down coastal because it was cheaper to live down here and we could get more for our money. So we did. And I did that by myself with the children because, again, he was away working. So I had a lot going on. And again, so I moved to a new town and felt really lonely, really isolated. So the only way I could make friends was through the children and alcohol.
Yeah.
So I made friends through the children initially, so like from baby groups and things like that, because I had to get myself out there. And then again, it was just another big group of young mums, and that was how they socialised. That's how I socialised. So the drinking just continued. You know, he was away, I single-handedly looked after the children. I was then isolated in a town, which I didn't really realise at the time. And then I just had these nights out, and it was the only way that I could, again, decompress and cope with my life, the stress. So that's what I did for a long time, until lockdown happened. And then lockdown, I actually really reduced my alcohol consumption. I mean, it wasn't a great time for me, as it wasn't anyone. My husband at the time was locked down in another country, so I was quite isolated with the children here on my own. But I would have like the odd wine here and there, but I didn't actually binge drink like I usually would. But I really missed going out and drinking and socialising, so I couldn't wait for lockdown to ease and to get straight back to it. And then when the lockdown did ease, that's when I went off the rails. And it was like, yeah, it was just high strength drinks. Like, I started experiencing blackouts. It was all or nothing mindset, binge drinking. Yeah, and then obviously that would then come with the really long hangovers that would last like a week. I was struggling to function, get up, take care of the house, like just normal stuff that you should be dealing with in life. Like, because obviously I was so hungover from these, you know, these nights out where I never wanted to even come home. You know, like I'd go out for the night, I'd be out till 6 o'clock in the morning because I just didn't want to come home and face my life, because I've, looking back now, I realised I was really unhappy and really lonely, but didn't really understand that at the time. You just use alcohol as that way of just suppressing everything, don't you? So yeah, so that's a bit in a nutshell of it's just binge drinking and just the only way I knew how to socialise, really.
Yeah, and cope as well, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
it just becomes a coping mechanism. Because for you, you know, having your children young and then being a mum at home, you know, husband away, you're still essentially a child yourself in your mid-20s. You know, your brain's not fully mature.
No.
Until your late 20s, and yet there you are, this really young person with two young kids and no physical kind of like emotional support. It's just on a kind of telephone line, I guess, as and when you can get in touch. I mean, that's you know, you're really carrying such a big load there.
I didn't really realize it. It's mad. Like, at the time, if you told me that I was too young to have children, I'd have been like, absolutely not, so ready for this. But now I look back and I think, oh my goodness.
Yeah. I relate to that, you know, in a different way, because actually I personally waited, you know, quite a long time to have kids. I had my first baby at 35. I did lose a baby before then, but I had my first baby at 35 and my second at 37 and my third at 43. But for me, I still didn't realise what it meant to be a parent. Like, I wanted this mum. I wanted to be a mum because everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people just follow that route, right? Like, you get married, you have kids, you do, you have a house. And, you know, I struggle with parenting now, and I'm the most mature I've ever been. And actually, arguably, where I am in my life right now, I'm the most healed I've ever been in my life. But I'm still really struggling with the ins and outs of being a parent and the load and everything that comes with that. And I have remarried, I have met someone, and I've got a partner now. But so I'm just thinking, like, I'm really struggling now as a grown-up person in my 40s. I can't imagine what it must have been like, actually, if I'd have had those responsibilities and that pressure and that load in my 20s, and then without that support. It's just, you know, I think sometimes when we look back over our drinking life, you can see why we lean on certain things, why we're so desperate. Have that 5 minutes, that 10 minutes, that 10 hours on our own just to reconnect with ourselves. It's quite sad, really, isn't it? There's a lot.
Lots of things are like internalized towards us as well, though, isn't it? Like, you know, like it's internalized that you should get married, you should have children, and then you'll be happy. And like drinking as well, like it's pushed upon our culture. You know, from when I was a kid, like I remember going to parties and things with my parents and like two chairs being pushed together, and I was, you know, the kids would just go to sleep, you know, we'll just carry on till the early hours. Like that was normal.
Yeah, I know. And that, you know, that's what helps to shape our beliefs, I think, in life as well. Like the experiences that we have when we're younger, and like you said, this social conditioning, which is very, very prevalent still, especially as well around mummy wine and, you know, that decompressing from hard day at work or, you know, difficult day with the kids or, you know, any day with the kids. It's still such a strong narrative in a lot of our lives, and it does create that disconnect. I don't know about for you, but you know, for me, I was doing what I thought I should be doing, trying to survive, and then drinking to kind of be myself, just like you, real party girl drinker, binge drink at weekends, social thing. I did then drink at home a lot as well, but I think I always felt like, I don't know, like I never felt truly happy. It was always like there was something still slightly missing. And it took me a really long time. It actually took me to getting sober to work out,
yeah,
you know, what those things were for me. Like, did you have any, when you look back, did you have any instances where you were like, oh, I you know, I wish I didn't drink? Or,
oh yeah, I think, with my relationship with alcohol, like I remember being like in my 20s, and I mean, I must have been really happy at that point in my relationship. I think I was lonely. I was definitely happy in my relationship, but I was definitely lonely, but didn't realise it, because it didn't really lead me to make many bad decisions. Like I was out and I was having fun. I was the party girl, but like I was still, I think, in control. As time went on, and I think it really did take its toll, is when those things started to change, when I was making bad decisions and things that didn't sit very well with me morally as a person. And it progressively, the hangovers got worse as well. Like I could just shake it off. Yeah. But then it got to a point where I couldn't shake it off, and it was affecting me for like 2 or 3 days. So then that was then impacting my normal life, day-to-day life, and, you know, running around after the children and things like that. I just wasn't functioning very well, and it was taking its toll on me mentally. So yeah, it slowly crept up and got worse. I could shake it off when I was younger, and then it just got, I don't know what age that was really, but it just got to a point where I couldn't shake it off like I used to.
Yeah. What happened when you decided, like, that's enough? Like, what shaped that decision for you?
Lockdown. And I literally just had like a breakdown after lockdown. Everything just came to like a head. I realised, I think I was just really accountable with, I did a lot of self-reflection. So my mental health has been managed for the last 10 years through antidepressants. And I realised that that just masked everything. So in lockdown, because I was such a mentally low place, like many people was, and because I was so isolated and lonely because my partner was stuck abroad, I decided, I don't know why in my right mind, but I decided to come off my antidepressants because I thought life literally can't get any worse than this. I'm on my own with two children. No one wants to come nowhere near you. You can only go out for an hour a day. I know what, I'm just going to go off my antidepressants. So I did. Because I thought, well, this is the time, life can't get any worse. I need to be able to manage this. Like, you can't just mask everything through antidepressants. But I think that just unraveled everything. And I just started to feel again.
Right.
And after lockdown, I just went off the rails, just had it was almost like a breakdown, and I was just out, and it was like all or nothing mindset, drinking every weekend, every opportunity, socializing, I just almost like rebelled. So I started drinking things for the effect, not because I enjoyed them. So I wasn't drinking like wine or gin or things because I liked them. I was drinking things like Long Island iced teas because they had loads of alcohol in them, and I knew that if I only had a few of them, it would get me wrecked and it would be cheaper. And then obviously not coming home, dreading coming home, like being out till like 6 in the morning and just not wanting to come home and face my life. Started making some bad decisions, which now looking back was because, one, I was really lonely, but two, I was really disconnected and unhappy in my relationship. So almost like affair territory. I drunk drove, took drugs from a stranger whilst being really intoxicated, which that was always my thing. I was like, I never would touch drugs because my children always come first. And when that did happen on that one occasion, I was like, I need to be accountable for this because this is not okay. My marriage broke down. I did carry on drinking after that for a little while because I wasn't ready to put it down. But it was less. It was a lot less. I sort of carried on because I wasn't ready to obviously give it up, but I knew in the back of my head that that is what I needed to do. So that was when the problem really was starting to register. But I think that's because I was assessing everything in my life.
Yeah.
Like where I was going, what was going to happen. My life was changing. I was going to be doing life by myself. I needed to be accountable. I needed to self-reflect. I needed to sort my mental health out. It all just came to a massive head. So I think those types of things, the behaviour just wasn't sitting well with me morally as a person. It wasn't who I aspired to be. And I don't know, I was just accountable and just really realised that. Not everyone does though, do they? Like, I just felt like I'm either going to go up or I'm going to go down. And I knew that I was on my way to an addiction. At the minute, it was a problem. But I knew that if I carried on, I was going to be heading towards addiction.
It's like living... I always think about, for me, in a similar place to you, when I was aware that I needed to do something, to change something, but it's frightening still to accept those thoughts, isn't it? It's like, it's frightening to accept the fact that you know you need to do something quite drastic, and it's kind of almost like taking the big deep breath and like, okay, let's do this. But I always felt like I was living on a knife edge. That's how it felt like for me towards the end. Literally, it was almost like there was a left and a right, and left was really bad and right was bad, but we'll get better. So, you know, and it's, and I feel forever grateful that I chose the right way, because like you, I honestly think that if I didn't stop drinking, that it would ruin my life. Like, I honestly felt like it would ruin my life. Something stupid would happen to me, and I would allow something stupid to happen.
Yeah, I felt like that as well, actually. Like, it was bad enough that I think actually alcohol was even part of my relationship breakdown. But Yeah, I felt the same. Like, I felt like I would be embracing a 12-step program and potentially going to rehab, or like it, I was heading that way.
Yeah.
I actually have an uncle that that died sort of quite recently, actually, and he was in the height of his addiction, and he'd battled with it for years. And I feel I have got a lot of other people around me as well. Like there's probably a handful of people that I can reel off that are in my social circle. I don't socialise with all the time, but I know them very well, and I'm quite educated on AA, CA, 12 steps program, that sort of stuff. So I do know a lot about it and what the program's about. So I sort of, having that education helped me massively, because people that don't know anything about addiction may not recognise until it's too late. But I sort of like always looked at those people that were sober and are in my life and in my social scene and admired them, that they had that strength, that they hit rock bottom and come back up. Mm. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? And like having those positive influences around you. I think that's why, you know, even things like social media and just having people talking about their challenges with things like drinking, it just offers hope, I think, to people. And I think that's really, really important, because the trouble with drinking, unlike drugs, I mean, I also have a history of both, but the trouble with drinking is that it's still so socially acceptable, and you're almost judged for not being able to do it properly,
or
not being able to do it right, or not being able to do it in a controlled way, despite the fact that it absolutely screws with your like biochemistry in your brain, and you know, and you know, it shuts down the parts of your brain that helps you make good decisions.
So it's just
so bizarre that we elevate this substance, but we're sort of looking at it, or looking at people that are using it in a way that's like, you've got to always find the magic kind of place with drinking where you have enough but you don't have too much, and that you never cross those lines, because if you don't have enough, you're boring, and if you have too much, well, you're all these bad things. And I don't know, it's such a bizarre situation that we're in, I think, in this current day and age with alcohol. It is so easy to have a problematic relationship with this stuff. It is so easy, and there are many people out there that have problematic relationships that aren't even aware that, you know, just like what you were saying, whether they go into full-blown, you know, needing it daily to you know, depending on it, you know, that's kind of beside the point. It's almost like we just have this destructive relationship with this substance. And it's bizarre that when we want to walk away from it, you know, it's almost like we're kind of labelled the bad guys or the boring
ones. Yeah, it's uneducated people though, isn't it? It's like we're labelled as the problem of not being able to control it, but actually the problem is alcohol.
The problem is alcohol.
Addictive. It's not 100%. Us, you know.
Yes.
Because alcohol masked who I truly was as a person.
Yeah.
Now that I've put it down, I know who I am. Like, yeah. I've really learned a lot about myself. Like, yeah, it's just uneducated people. Educate yourself, open your mind, open your horizons, and actually learn, you know, what is healthy and what's not. It's the same as relationships. What's a healthy relationship? What's not a healthy relationship?
Yes.
With all sorts of things.
I think we get stuck quite a lot on default thought patterns. You know, we create these thought patterns when we're really young and almost too immature, and confirmation bias, you know, thinking about the same things every day and believing those thought patterns, having those beliefs, create our reality. And actually, you know, for me, probably the same for you as well, from the sounds of it. But for me, I got into sobriety, I was in my early 40s, and I suddenly started to really question all the things that I believed in,
and
the thoughts that I had about myself, which were really damaging and unhelpful and unsupportive things that I was thinking about myself. And it just shows you that there's so much immaturity in our belief systems. We just form them from a young age, and then that's it. You know, we live by them and we believe them, and we have to look at that stuff and break that stuff down and say, no, hang on a minute. That's not who I want to be. That's not who I really am. So getting to the bit where you actually, what happened on the day that you just said, you know, that's it?
So it was over Christmas. So it was the first Christmas that I'd been spending with a new partner, and Christmas would be looking very different than what I had previously been used to, because obviously my life had changed quite drastically. So, yeah, so I'd bought a couple of bottles of wine and I was spending it with people that I hadn't before. The moderation thing had been bothering me for a while, the fact that I couldn't moderate, you know. I wasn't going out and socialising at this point really like I used to. I wasn't going out on mad nights out, because obviously I'd been through separating and, yeah, life was quite sort of traumatic, should we say, for a while. So I was keeping it a bit, I was keeping myself a bit low key. So I was only really going for dinner and things. But again, even at dinner, like date nights with my new partner, I wasn't able to moderate. Like, it would always be like 5-6 large glasses of wine just during a meal. Like, just excessive. Like, it, most people just go and have one or two glasses, not me. It was like 5-6 big glasses of wine, and blacking out, you know, even on just a meal. So yeah, it was Christmas. I'd bought a couple of bottles of wine, spent it with people that I wasn't used to, told myself that I was going to moderate, knowing full well that the people that I would be spending it with, they weren't really drinkers, so they probably weren't going to view it like I was. And I couldn't moderate, so both bottles of wine went. No one else was drinking. It was absolutely unnecessary for me to drink that much. But it was just like the last nail for me. Like, it was only a small incident. Like, I didn't embarrass myself or anything like that. But I just got to the point where I'd been thinking it and not acting on it. And I just thought, Charlotte, you can't moderate. You've proven that again. Like, we're going into a new year, New Year's resolutions and all that. Perhaps just try like a dry January and see how you get on.
Yeah.
I do think my intention was to give up full stop, but I just thought, look, if you could put it down during January, see how you get on. So that was just like my first little goal that I think I had in my head, that, like, right, so Boxing Day, after Boxing Day, put it down, see how you get on. And so I did, and I haven't looked back.
Wow, that's amazing, isn't it? Gives me goosebumps, that. I just think, yeah, it's like sliding doors moment, you know.
Yeah,
or just giving it a go, you know. For you, that's what's obviously worked for you, just giving it a go, going in with that intention, and then look at you, you know, 579 days sober. It's amazing. So what did you do? You'd sort of got yourself into that mindset, you're going to give it a try. What did you do to help yourself? I mean, January is a great time, right, to do it, because everyone is...
Yeah, and no one's got any money either, have they? So, like, people aren't partying like that. But I think because of my experiences with my relationship breakdown, I had took a step back from the party life anyway. Yeah. So I was keeping myself quite low-key, so that really did help. So I stuck to just meals out. The first meal out was tricky. I really did crave that glass of wine, but I said to myself, no, like, don't do it. So I didn't. And a friend of mine, who was sober, his go-to drink was soda and lime.
Yeah.
So I thought, right, I'm just going to order that and drink that. So yeah, after the meal, I didn't drink and the initial craving went, I was like, oh my God, that was easy. And then the next morning, obviously, I woke up fresh and I was like, this is really nice. So I really enjoyed that and I just felt really present, and I still was able to maintain a conversation throughout the meal without being silly on alcohol.
Yeah.
Because it does give you that Dutch courage, and it does, you know, if you can moderate, you know, it is fun, isn't it? Like, you know, it does loosen you and it gives you this false bit of confidence, and you know, that they are the positives when you do start drinking, isn't it? So yeah, so after the first meal, you know, it was like a milestone. So then after that, it just got easier. My partner as well, he isn't a big drinker, so he would just have a drink because I was having a drink.
Yeah.
So he was like, oh, well, if you're not going to drink, I'm not going to drink. So he didn't drink, so that made life a bit easier. But I also embraced fitness. So for the last 10 years, I've always been very fit and healthy apart from the drinking. So everything I had been doing in the gym, I was undoing with alcohol. And the overeating as well, like when you're hungover because you crave energy and stuff like that. So I had a marathon booked, my first one, which was like a tick off the bucket list. And giving up in January set me up for amazing success for that marathon, which I was running in the April. So that was my other goal as well, was that I wasn't going to drink for the marathon. So I had that to focus on. So I had 4 months of intense training. So that really helped. And I surrounded myself with like-minded people. You know, I stuck to my gym community, people that were health focused. And I actually realized that a lot of my friendships and relationships were alcohol based. And I was actually their entertainment.
Yeah,
because I was the party girl.
Yeah, same.
Because I was fun, and because, you know, I was known for my crazy nights out and not coming home till 6 o'clock in the morning and how much fun I was. It's safe to say that I don't have a lot of those friends now, you know.
We don't have anything in common now.
Yeah. Because I don't drink and I'm not fun.
Yeah. Yeah, in inverted commas, which you've just done, which obviously people can't hear. People can't see that you've just done that. Yeah, I know. And also, I think, did you notice that you felt a shift in your personality when you stopped drinking?
Like, massively. I think I know my identity now.
Yeah,
I know who I am as a person. I know who I have aspired to be, and I'm really content with myself. Just self-reflection is so important. And how can you do that when you're drinking?
Yeah. Well, I don't think you even realise that it's a thing to do. Because I feel a bit like when I was drinking, I was just always on a bus in a way. Just like going in a certain direction, and I was just like going with the flow of it, going along with all the people and doing all the things and trapped in the same thought patterns. And I wasn't really, I tell a lie actually, I do remember in my 20s and 30s thinking there's got to be more to life than this. But then just sort of like pushing that thought down and just going out and just not worried about it. But I definitely had those thoughts regularly popping up, which I think was my inner wisdom saying, Terry, there is more to life than this. Like, you are destined for more, and there is a better relationship that you can have with yourself than what you're doing. But I just was a bit tunnel vision. Do you know what I mean? I was a bit tunnel vision. I was just like, was always just on the drinking bus with all the people doing all the things. And that was my life for a really long time. And I was very much in the mindset of like, well, things are all happening to me. And do you know what I mean? Like, maybe sometimes slightly victim mindset. Like, oh, there wasn't a lot of responsibility. I wasn't in a position to realise that I could take responsibility and change things. I just felt like it's like being on a conveyor belt almost. It's just on a conveyor belt.
Yeah, I agree with you there, because I never took responsibility for anything. Like, anything that I did whilst drinking was okay because I was drunk.
Yeah.
It wasn't really me.
Yeah. Now I feel like I really have quite multi-dimensional thinking now. Like, I think about what I'm thinking about. Do you know what I mean? Like, I really, like what you're saying with that, like, self-reflection. But back then, I was very like one or two dimensional. I don't know. I just wasn't really paying a lot of attention. And I feel now like sobriety opened the gateway to change that for me. Like it was a really big step in changing that for me. But I feel fascinated now about people that don't get to that gateway, and what does that look like for them? Not in a judgmental way, but do they get to the end of their life and maybe have regrets and things? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just, I find it quite fascinating. I feel fortunate, as I'm sure you do as well, that I got to the point where I thought, enough is enough here. I need to really buckle down and stop this negative pattern in my life and do something better.
Do you know what? I had this conversation with my mum the other day, and my mum, I quite often worry about her because she's young. Like, I mean, she's not even 60 yet, but she's not particularly healthy. Like, I mean, she is, but she's not at the same time. I'm more healthy as an individual than she is. You know, she vapes, she drinks, she binge drinks. She's got a really unhealthy relationship with food. She's up and down weight. And I actually had this conversation with her the other day that at 33, the light switched on for me. And I feel like that's really young to be like, prioritise fitness, health, how I eat, my hormones, you know, I've chosen to be sober. Like all these things that I've done for myself at such a young age. And then I look at my mum and I absolutely adore her, but I just think, how have you not realised that at your age?
Yeah.
You're nearly 60 and you're still behaving like I was when I was 33. And I've realised that now. So I feel like my priority is to have the longest life possible. I want to be here as long as possible to be around for my children and all these amazing memories and milestones that we've got to come. And then I'm just like, why are you choosing to vape? Why are you choosing to binge drink? Why are you not exercising? I don't get it.
No, I don't get it either. And I do relate. I think that there's a clarity that comes with when you stop drinking and you start going more inward and listening to your own inner whispers and inner voice and things like that, and trusting your intuition. I think that there is a clarity that comes that you don't access when you are on that conveyor belt. And being on that conveyor belt, you know, a lot of people that will be drinking, you know, are on that conveyor belt. So I can only put it down to that. I think that, you know, I've got a couple of people in my community that are really young. They're in their 20s. They're in their early 20s. And they absolutely, it amazes me that they are, you know, in their 20s, they're trying to quit drinking. I just have so much respect for that. Like I was, just wasn't able to do that at that age. And it's like it's brilliant. And not only are you now in a position to sort of help yourself heal in your own life, you offer that to your children too. That's the beauty. You know?
I mean, perhaps we didn't have that education, Terry, but I know for sure my kids have definitely got that education because they talk about not drinking and they worry about my mum as well and even their own dad as well. I mean, he doesn't drink as much now, I don't think, but he does vape and they really worry about things like that as well. Because that's the other thing as well, is I classed myself as a non-smoker after I had my children, but then I'd have a drink and smoke.
Yeah, same.
So
yeah.
I was a social smoker.
Yeah.
And that didn't sit well with me either because I didn't want to smoke.
Yeah.
Talking about sober, obviously when you go on your first night out and stuff like that, it's obviously a bit different, isn't it? And recently I've just been to a wedding and it was my first sober wedding, and do you know what my favorite part of the wedding was, which I would never have said this before, but it was the ceremony. It was so emotional. Before, that would have been so boring to me, and the party bit would have been just like the life and soul and the best bit of the wedding. But on this occasion, honestly, I got so much enjoyment from just watching this couple marry and the ceremony. Like, it was just, it was so lovely.
Oh, do you know, I think sober weddings are wonderful. It is a big thing that we fear, I think, as well. When you're in early sobriety, it's like, how do you do the holidays and Christmases and the weddings? And because they're so heavily associated with drinking. But I remember my first sober wedding. I couldn't believe how long it was.
I know, it was really long day. I mean, really? I was actually a bridesmaid, so I was there at 6 a.m.
Wow.
I was knackered by the end of the day, but I didn't miss it.
Yeah.
Did not miss it. And I got so much enjoyment. Like, I did have a little dance and stuff, which I did fear, because I thought, oh, am I still going to have the same, like, confidence of dancing? But I got loads of enjoyment watching everyone else.
Yeah.
As well.
Now I feel like I try to get up and dance at any opportunity, If there's even a little kid's fate, I'm like up with my little one dancing. I'm that mum now. I find it really joyful. I really love dancing, and I don't think about anyone else in that moment. And it's just so nice that you can still do all these things that you did do as a kid, funnily enough. And really,
yeah.
But at some point along the way, we just... alcohol comes into the picture and then steals all the credit, and then we believe we always need it and that we can't do anything else anymore without it. I mean, it's
without it,
bad, isn't it? But
I know,
we still do things without it. We can do everything without it.
Yeah.
So what have been the biggest gains for you then? And I know obviously we talked about a lot of positive stuff, but you know, what for you have been the biggest things that you've got from not drinking?
Right. So my biggest gains would be being my authentic self, for sure. That one for sure. And I genuinely feel like, I don't know, I because of my separation, I did carry a lot of guilt for my children. The fact that I wasn't able, like, I felt like I fouled not being able to provide that two-parent family. But I honestly feel like since I've put down alcohol that I've been the best, most present mum for my children. Yeah. You know, just, they both play sport, you know, Sunday morning at matches, just being there, you know, early, like really early, like sometimes it's like 8, 9 o'clock. I would absolutely dread those types of things before. But like now, you know, I'm there, I'm embracing it, I'm watching it, I'm encouraging them, I'm getting them there without any question. They are truly, I put them first in everything. And I just feel like I'm such a better mum for it. Mm. Just consistently operating, not always at 100%, because don't get me wrong, you do still get tired and things like that, but I'm not running low like I was on those hangovers, just operating. I need to be running at 90 to 100% to be able to cope with my life.
Yeah.
And the demands of it as well. So putting alcohol down has allowed me to do that, which is great. I've gained a lot of time back as well that I wasted to hangovers.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, like, if you go on a night out, say, for instance, a Saturday night, it would take up the whole of my Saturday, because you're running around as a young girl, woman, outfits, eyelashes, hair, makeup. Like, it's a lot of prep to go out.
Yeah.
And then you go out for the evening, and then the next day you're hungover all day.
Yeah.
So that's like my whole weekend gone.
I know, it's mad.
And then, you know, who's looking after my kids? My mum.
Yeah.
So what am I gaining from it? Or, you know, the mother-in-law or whoever, you know, what actually am I gaining from that? Sore head, you know, a load of bad decisions, unable to cope with my life during the week. Yeah. Physical and mental gains, though, I would say, is that I have clear skin. I don't suffer with acne anymore. I've battled for years to try and figure out what gave me acne, and now I've realised it's alcohol.
Oh my God, really?
I thought it was dairy, hormones, you know, you name it, I put it down to it. Since I've put down alcohol, I don't get spots.
God.
So I'm wondering whether I was allergic to it.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, amazing.
But yeah, like cortisol levels, like sometimes I'd notice like from pictures and stuff that if I was like intoxicated, my face would swell. It's almost like really high, like I just would be puffy, like in these pictures. And it was, I'm assuming that was down to alcohol. But yeah, I don't know, just little things like reduced mood swings and I don't know, prioritising my children though, that would be my number one.
Yeah, yeah. I know, I think we have enough on our plate, don't we? To be honest, as women, with all of our cycles and fluctuating hormones and PMS and PMDD and perimenopause and all those sorts of things playing havoc already. When you throw alcohol on top of that, no, it's just a recipe for disaster, isn't it? It's just...
Yeah. I think as well, Terry, I mean, I know a lot of people sort of like throw around sort of like ADHD, autism, things like that now, without actually having like formal diagnosis and stuff. But I know that from your social media, you've been diagnosed.
Yeah, yeah. So ADHD and autistic, yeah.
So I do have a very strong suspicion that I do have ADHD. I just haven't done anything about it yet. And I have done a lot of reading that alcohol doesn't go hand in hand with people that are on the spectrum. Don't know if there's much truth in that. I'm sure you would know. But yeah, I do have a suspicion that I have those tendencies. You know, I've quite a busy mind. You're just constantly chasing dopamine, aren't you, if you're 100%. That
yeah, type of 100%. Your brain is wired for addiction when you're ADHD, 100%. And this is a very growing link, I think, that I see in the community, in the sober community, especially with women, that there are a lot of women that stop drinking and then they just start to connect the dots a little bit on, well, you know, I was quite all or nothing, or, you know, whatever the list of things are. But
yeah.
And I think that it's, you know, it's okay. It's absolutely okay to lean into those kinds of thoughts. And I do think there is still a bit of negativity around, like, oh, everyone's ADHD now, or everyone's autistic now. And that, you know, that annoys me really, because I think, well, actually, there's a really, really huge chunk of undiagnosed people out there that have struggled in life for different reasons, and, or that have scraped by in certain situations and not really understood what, you know, might be at play. And actually we're just starting to uncover some of this stuff, and it's helping people to heal, and it's helping people to make sense of their lives, make sense of their over drinking or whatever other things that they, you know, might do over the top or whatever. And I think it's important. I think it's important, a conversation to keep having, and that there is a growing link. And my views on neurodivergence is actually, at the moment, we're still very, very behind the curve on this. We still think that there is a big portion of people over here that are neurotypical, and there is a portion of people over here that are ADHD, autistic, whatever. I actually think that that group of people is much bigger than we realise, and that actually we're just kind of like crayons in a box. We're all just different colours. there's nothing wrong with us. We're just wired in this way of crayons, right? Neurotypicals are the blue crayons. ADHD is of the green crayon, and I do think that in the next sort of 10 years this will be very normalized, and we'll have more
understanding.
Even my children, right, I have three ADHD autistic children, two diagnosed, one still too young to be diagnosed, but I know, right, I just know because I know this stuff now. But I talk to them about their brains, so, you know, with things like Roblox and stuff, you know, the game. I said to my middle child, she's getting quite addicted to it, I said, look, you have to understand that your brain is wired for addiction.
Yeah.
And we have those conversations, and they're conversations that I didn't have as a kid because we didn't know this stuff. And I feel grateful to be able to bring this conversation.
Yeah.
And my little one listens to me. She's put the roadblocks down for now. You know, she has other games. I'm not anti-screens at all. With neurodivergent children, I just don't believe you can be anti-screens.
You can't be, no.
You can't be. But, you know, she's listening. And so she knows I'm sober. She knows that, you know, I'm sassy sober mum. And, you know, she's only 9. And I feel like, yeah, proud to have those kinds of to help her understand and navigate. Look, you're going to be more prone to get involved in dangerous situations because you're also autistic and you're not able to, you haven't got the potentially the radar to spot things like some other people have. And you have to, you know, just have those sorts of chats, really. I think it's really, really, especially for women. I think it's for girls.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, me and my daughter actually had a similar conversation recently because, like you said about connecting the dots, I've kind of connected the dots with her, but I don't really know where to start or to begin with it. So I've done typical me and buried my head in the sand for a while. But she started playing Fortnite and we'd avoided it for a long while, actually. It was only when she was about 10 that she got a PS5 for her birthday and started playing Fortnite. Anyway, my card was linked to the account and there had been a couple of occasions where she'd bought herself some V-Bucks without my permission. So I didn't shame her for it. I mean, obviously, we did have a conversation and I did say that it was wrong, which she did. But I also made her aware that I do also understand what she's done because I believe her brain is wired up for dopamine, like what we've discussed. And if you've got a card that's attached to an account and you're a 10-year-old child and your mum said no to V-Bucks and the card sat there and all your friends have got V-Bucks and you're going, oh, I really need V-Bucks. You know, these games are designed for you to spend money. They're designed for dopamine, that sort of stuff. Yeah. So I was like, I do understand why you've done it. It's wrong. You are going to have to pay mummy back the money for that. And you will learn your lesson. But I'm not going to shame you for it because I do also understand why you've done it because it's so easy. It's one click of a button. It's like an Amazon order. Yeah. Click, it's here tomorrow.
Yes. Yeah, because I got the same problem with Timu, right? My 9-year-old has a little card. She has an allowance, like a Go Henry thing. And she's constantly creating orders on Timu to buy these little thing. And again, it's dopamine buying.
So but it's cheap as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really cheap. And it comes in a post and you open it up and she's got like 1,000 of the same thing. And she rips open 30 of them and then never looks at them again, you know.
And they go in the bin.
Such dopamine, you know, hunting behavior. And I relate to that, right? I didn't have that opportunity to do that as a kid, but I used to open a pantry cupboard and have spoons of sugar. Because I needed like my equivalent of a hit at the time. And obviously then we had MTV. That was the thing when I was a teenager. But yeah, so I think they're important conversations. And you know, it's taken me probably a good 12 months to wrap my head around it and to get used to it. And there's a grief that comes along with that as well, when you realise that you were probably undiagnosed neurodivergent. And like you said earlier, you know, I had the inkling as soon as you said about you didn't fit in, you had trouble at school. I was like, that's a common story, right? That was my story. I got expelled at bloody 15 for just not going, you know, because I just wasn't going and because I was struggling so much. And so, you know, sometimes when you look back and look through that lens, there is a sadness there, but how brilliant that can then be turned into something positive for your children so that they can, you know, hopefully learn more younger about their brains. And like you said, not feel the shame, because I was just shamed and you were probably just shamed as well.
Yeah.
For like being the way we were. But my, you know, my middle daughter is, her ADHD is much more in the driving seat. And she is very fidgety, you know, she can't sit on her bottom at the table and it's all the kind of classic, you know, fidgety things. And we just don't come down on her for that now, you know? We're just like, because I understand it. And if she breaks something or she's clumsy or she walks, we're just like, it's okay. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, we accept you for who you are. And more importantly, I understand why you're, because I was like that too. And so I think that as well, hopefully they just won't grow up with those shaming wounds that I do think a lot of our generation and older generations have had to deal with that.
Yeah.
But yeah. So what would be, before we wrap up, really interested in what your top three tips would be for getting and staying successfully sober?
Choose your company wisely. Show me your friends, I'll show you your future. That always sticks out for me, and I say that to my children all the time. They're only 10 and 12, but I'm like, girls, who you hang around with seriously is so important. So yeah, so that's been a massive one for me, because I've obviously put down, well, actually, I don't know, have I put my alcohol friends down or have they put me down? I'm not sure. Obviously you keep your real ones, and I've gained a lot through uni as well, surrounded myself with like-minded people, and I've gained a lot through my gym community, which is such a great community. But yeah, I had a lot of friends that I just socialized with because of alcohol, and it's the only thing we had in common. It's really quite sad. I would say, obviously, I spoke a lot about self-reflection and being accountable. And if you need to heal, like, I mean, most people have gone through traumatic experiences, heal yourself, like, do the work. And gratitude, like spirituality, you were saying as well, that really helped me, being grateful. I think every day you could be grateful for 10 things. Without a doubt.
Yeah.
So I did do a lot of that whilst I was getting sober. Gratitude list every day, 10 things. That really helped me. Last one, probably, I don't know, like, just seek genuine joy in, like, the little everyday things.
Yeah.
And just give it a go. Put alcohol down and just genuinely give it a go.
Yeah.
I could guarantee that you put it down, I don't think most people would look back.
Mm. Well, they say, don't they, no one regrets getting sober. So
No.
Yeah. It's not associated with regret traditionally, is it? Not drinking.
No, just chase healthy, real dopamine if you're that type of person.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll crave it, we'll like it, we'll need it.
Yeah.
But just it's mad. Like, I've done quite a lot of fitness things. Like, I did my marathon and I've done a few fitness competitions and stuff like that. It genuinely takes me a couple of days to come down after an event like that.
Yeah.
Of just real dopamine.
Yeah. The high, the natural high.
Love. The natural highs that you get from those types of things. Honestly, it takes me about 2 or 3 days to have like a come down from it. And it's just a fitness competition.
Yeah. But there is an infographic somewhere, I've seen it, where it shows the dopamine that you get, the spike that you get from drinking, which goes immediately like straight up. But then immediately crashes straight down, and that's drinking. And then when you compare that to real dopamine, like, you know, doing your event, for example, it might be slower to build and it might not get quite as crazy high, but it's not far off, but it always lasts longer.
Yeah.
It's an actual, that's an actual, you know, it's a scientific diagram out there somewhere in the internet world. You know, that image always sticks with me, and that's what you're describing. You know, it takes a long time to come down off it. And that's how it should be. Like, alcohol always gives you what I call that 15 out of 10 artificial, you know, chemically laden dopamine hit, which is, you know, there's no real happiness there. There's
sort of, no, and it doesn't last either by the sounds of it, because you're depressed and low the next day, aren't you?
Yeah. We always, and then you're always chasing. Like, unfortunately, when you're up at that 15 out of 10, what comes close to that, right? Not very much. So you're putting all of your future happiness in the chemical 15 out of 10 dopamine basket that only alcohol can achieve. And so that dims the joy of everything else as well, which is really sad. So, yeah, be brave and put the drink down. Lovely way to finish and to wrap up. Thank you so much, Charlotte. It's been a wonderful chat with you. I really appreciate your openness and your honesty.
Yeah, thank you. It's been great, actually. I actually get so much enjoyment just, like, hoping that this will help someone else that's thinking about putting it down and embracing the sober life.
Yeah, absolutely.
You will, and it's nice to talk to someone who's like-minded as well, because you're quite similar, aren't you? Yeah. In lots of ways.
Yeah, definitely. Lots of similarities in our stories, actually. And I just always think that that's also really healing when you think in a certain way like you, or been through similar things. And yeah, I just think it's really, really healing. That's why community is so key, right? That's why it's so important, I think.
Definitely. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. And thank you to everyone else. Until next time, goodbye.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you're interested in being a guest, please contact me directly on Instagram by sending a message to @sassysobermum. You can also find helpful tools and resources on my website, sassysobermum.com. If you enjoyed the podcast and you want to spread the love, please like, share, and rate the podcast. I really look forward to next time. See you then.